Now he raised his voice, calling in that high, almost petulant tone, "Ballantyne!" And Zuga Ballantyne spurred his horse up beside the window and leaned attentively from the saddle.
"Tell me, my dear fellow," Rhodes demanded, "what is this new building to be?"
He pointed at the freshly opened foundation trenches and the stacks of red-burned brick piled on the corner plot at the intersection of two of Bulawayo's wide and dusty streets.
"That's the new synagogue," Zuga told him.
"So my Jews have come to stay,"
Mr. Rhodes said with a smile, and Zuga suspected that Mr. Rhodes had known precisely what those foundations were for, but had asked the question to pave the way for his own witticism.
"Then my new country will be all right, Ballantyne. They are the birds of good omen, who would never roost in a tree marked for felling."
Zuga chuckled dutifully, and then went on talking while Ralph Ballantyne, riding in the bunch, watched them with such interest that he neglected the lady riding beside him until she tapped him on the forearm with her crop.
"I said it will be interesting to see what happens when we reach Kami," Louise repeated,
and Ralph's attention jerked back to his stepmother. She rode astride, the only woman he knew that did so, and though she wore ankle-length divided skirts, her seat was elegant and sure. Ralph had seen her outride his own father, beating him in a grueling point-to-point race over rough terrain. That had been in Kimberley, before the trek to the north and this land. But the years had treated Louise kindly indeed. Ralph smiled to himself as he recalled the youthful crush he had been smitten with, when first he saw her driving her phaeton and pair of golden palominos down Kimberley's crowded main street. That was so many years ago. And though she had married his father since then, he still felt a special affection for her that was definitely neither filial nor dutiful. She was only a few years older than he was, and the Blackfoot Indian blood in her veins gave her beauty a certain timeless element.
"I cannot imagine that even Robin, my honoured aunt and mother-in-law, would use the occasion of her youngest daughter's marriage for political advantage," Ralph said.
"Are you confident enough to wager on that, a guinea, say?" Louise asked, with a flash of even white teeth, but Ralph threw back his head and laughed.
"I've learned my lesson. I'll never bet against you again."
Then he dropped his voice.
"Besides, I don't really have that much faith in my mother-in-law's restraint."
"Then why on earth does Mr. Rhodes insist on going to the wedding? He must know what to expect."
"Well, firstly, he owns the land that the mission is built upon. And secondly, he probably feels that the ladies of Kami Mission are depriving him of a valued possession."
Ralph lifted his chin to indicate the bridegroom, who rode a little ahead of the group. Harry Mellow had a flower in his buttonhole, a gloss on his boots, and a grin upon his lips.
"He hasn't lost him," Louise pointed out. "He fired him as soon as he realized he couldn't talk Harry out of it. But he's such a talented geologist. They say he can smell gold a mile away."
"Mr. Rhodes does not approve of his young men marrying, no matter how talented."
"Poor Harry. Poor Vicky. What will they do?"
"Oh, it's all arranged," Ralph beamed.
"You?" she hazarded.
"Who else?"
"I should have known. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me to learn that you engineered the whole business," Louise accused,
and Ralph looked pained.
"You do me a grave injustice, Mama."
He knew she did not like that title, and used it deliberately to tease her. Then Ralph looked ahead, and his expression changed like a bird dog scenting the pheasant. The wedding party had ridden out past the last new buildings and shanties of the town onto the broad, rutted wagon road. Coming towards them up from the south was a convoy of transport wagons. There were 10 of them, so strung out that the furthest of them were marked only by columns of fine white dust rising above the flat-topped acacia trees. On the nearest wagon tent, Louise could already read the company name. Rowlands, the shortened form of Rhodesian Lands and Mining Company, which Ralph had chosen as the umbrella for his multitudinous business activities.
"Damn me," he exclaimed happily, "old Izasi has brought them in 5 days ahead of schedule. That little black devil is a miracle."
He tipped his hat in apology to Louise.
"Business calls, excuse me, please, Mama."
And he galloped ahead, swinging off his horse as he came level with the lead wagon, and embracing the diminutive figure in cast-off military-style jacket, who skipped at the flank of the bullock team brandishing a 30-foot-long trek whip.
"What kept you so long, Izasi?" Ralph demanded. "Did you meet a pretty Matabele girl on the road?"
The little Zulu driver tried not to grin, but the network of wrinkles that covered his face contracted, and there was a puckish sparkle in his eyes.
"I can still deal with a Matabele girl and her mother and all her sisters in the time it would take you to inspire a single ox."
It was not only a declaration of virility, but also an oblique reference to Ralph's skill as a teamsman. Izasi had taught him all he knew of the open road, but still treated Ralph with the indulgent condescension usually reserved for a small boy.
"No, little hawk, I did not want to rob you of too much bonus money by bringing them in more than 5 days ahead."
This was a gentle reminder of what Izasi expected in his next pay packet. Now the little Zulu, with the head ring granted him by King Cetshwayo before the Battle of Ulundi still upon his snowy head, stood back and looked at Ralph with the speculative eye he usually reserved for a bullock.
"How, Henshaw, what finery is this?"
He glanced at Ralph's suit and English boots, and at the sprig of mimosa blossom at Ralph's buttonhole.
"Even flowers like a simpering maiden at her first dance! And what is under your coat? Surely the Nkosikasi is the one who carries the babies in your family?"
Ralph glanced down at his own midriff.
Izasi was being unfair. There was barely a trace of superfluous flesh there, nothing that a week of hard hunting would not remove. But Ralph sustained the banter that they both enjoyed.
"It is the privilege of great men to wear fine apparel and to eat good food," he said.
"Then fall to, little hawk with the fine feathers."
Izasi shook his head disapprovingly.
"Eat your fill. While wiser men do the real work, you play like a boy."
His tone belied the warmth of his smile, and Ralph clasped his shoulder. "There was never a driver like you, Izasi, and there probably never will be again."
"How, Henshaw? So I have taught you something, even if only to recognize true greatness when you see it."
Izasi chuckled at last, and put the long lash up into the air with a report like a shot of cannon, and called to his oxen.
"Come, Fransman, you black devil! Come, Satan, my darling! Pakimisa, pick it up!"
Ralph mounted and backed his horse off the road, and watched his laden wagons trundle by. There was £3,000 of profit in that single convoy for him, and he had 200 wagons plying back and forth across the vast subcontinent. Ralph shook his head in awe as he remembered the single elderly 18-footer that he and Izasi had driven out of Kimberley that first time. He had purchased it on borrowed money and laden it with trade goods that he did not own. "A long road and a hard one," he had said aloud as he wheeled his horse and kicked it into a gallop in pursuit of the mule coach and the wedding party. He fell in again beside Louise, and she started from the reverie, as though she had not even noticed his absence. "Dreaming," he accused her, and she spread the fingers of one graceful hand in admission of guilt, and then lifted it to point. "Do look, Ralph. How beautiful it is." A bird flitted across the track, ahead of the coach. It was a shrike, with a shiny black back, and a breast of a stunning crimson that burned in the white sunlight like a precious ruby. "How beautiful it all is," she exulted, as the bird disappeared into the scrub. And Louise turned in the saddle to take in the whole horizon with a sweep of her arm that made the tassels of her white buckskin jacket flutter. "Do you know, Ralph, that King's Lynn is the very first real home I have ever known?" And only then Ralph realized that they were still on her father's land. Zuga Ballantyne had used up the entire fortune he had won from the blue ground of Kimberley's Pit to buy the land grants of the drifters and never-contents amongst Dr. Jamieson's troopers who had ridden into Matabele land in the expeditionary force that had defeated Lobengula. Each of them had been entitled to 4,000 acres of his choice, and some of them had sold that right to Zuga Ballantyne for as little as the price of a bottle of whiskey. It would take a rider on a good horse 3 days to ride around the boundary of King's Lynn. The home that Zuga had built for Louise
stood on one of those distant hills overlooking the wide plain of acacia trees and sweet grass, its thick golden thatch and burned brick blending with the shading grove of tall trees, as though it had always been there. "This beautiful land will be so good to us," she whispered, her voice husky and her eyes brimming with an almost religious joy. "Vicky will be married today, and her children will grow strong here. Perhaps..." She broke off, and a little cloud passed behind her eyes. She had not yet given up all hope of bearing Zuga's child. Every night, after his gentle loving, she would lie with her hands clasped over her stomach and her thighs clenched, as if to hold his seed within her, and she would pray while he slept quietly beside her. Perhaps, but it would be ill-omened to even mention it, and she changed it. "Perhaps one day Jonathan, or one of your sons, yet unborn, will be the master of King's Lynn." She reached across and laid her hand on his forearm. "Ralph, I have the strange premonition that our descendants will live here forever." Ralph smiled fondly at her and covered her hand with his. "Well, now, my dear Louise, even Mr. Rhodes himself only gives it 4,000 years. Will you not settle for that?" "Oh, you!" She struck him playfully on the shoulder. "Will you never be serious?" And then she exclaimed and turned her horse out of the procession. Under one of the flat-topped acacias beside the track stood a pair of Matabele boys, neither of them older than 10 years. They wore only the little mucha loincloths, and hung their heads shyly as Louise greeted them in fluent, rippling Cinderbele. King's Lynn employed dozens of these mujiba to tend the vast herds of native cattle and the fine breeding bulls that Zuga had brought up from the south. These were but two of them, yet Louise knew them by name, and their faces shone with genuine affection as they returned her greeting. "I see you also, Balela," the praise name the Matabele servants of King's Lynn had given her, meant "the one who brings clear and sunny skies," and the two children waited expectantly, answering her questions dutifully, until Louise at last reached into the pocket of her skirt and dropped a morsel of candy into each of their cupped pink palms. They scampered back to their herds, cheeks bulging like those of squirrels, and their eyes huge with delight. "You spoil them," Ralph chided her, as she rejoined him. "They are our people," she said simply, and then almost regretfully. "Here is the boundary. I hate to leave our own land." And the wedding procession passed the simple roadside peg and rode onto the land of Carmi Mission Station. However, it was almost an hour later that the mules hauled the coach up the steep track, through thick bush, and paused to blow on the level neck of ground high above the whitewashed church and its attendant buildings. It seemed as though an army was encamped in the valley. Jordan jumped down from the coach, shrugging off the cotton dust coat that had protected his beautiful dove-grey suit, and smoothing his dense golden curls as he crossed to his brother. "What on earth is going on, Ralph?" he demanded. "I never expected anything like this. Robin has invited half the Matabele nation to the wedding, and the other half invited themselves." Ralph smiled down at his brother. "Some of them have trekked 100 miles to be here. Every patient she's ever treated, every convert she ever turned, every man, woman, and child who ever came to beg a favour or advice, everyone who ever called a Namuza, they are all here, and they have all brought their families and friends. It's going to be the greatest jollification since Loban Gula held the last Chawala ceremony back in 93. "But who's going to feed them all?" Jordan went immediately to the logistics. "Oh, Robin can afford to blow a few of her royalties, and I sent her a gift of 50 head of slaughter bullocks. Then they do say that Gundang's wife, old Fat Juba, has brewed 1,000 gallons of her famous Twala. They'll be bloated as pythons and overflowing with good cheer." Ralph punched his brother's arm affectionately. "Which reminds me that I have worked up a fair old thirst myself. Let's get on with it."